have to use birth control, but I'm not sure which one to use. I was wondering if there is a preferred halachic one. Halachically, there's a more preferred one. Speak louder. Ooh. No one has ever told me that before. Okay, I generally take care of that on my own. Okay, so for this, this actually is going to be a little bit of a review from last week, but that's okay. I had a condensate last week. When asking about birth control, there are two halachic concerns. When it comes to birth control, the biggest halachic concern would be how does it work? Does it interfere with the natural way of intercourse? Does it act as a barrier during intercourse? And is there anything called shchitat zera, which means wasting of the seed? The second thing to consider halachically when a woman is deciding which birth control to use is how her body is going to respond to that birth control. Based on what her body does responding to that, we know there are lots of different responses to all kinds of birth controls, that will have some halachic ramifications. Just to run through it, for the first concern of which birth controls do not interfere with the most natural way of intercourse. So obviously the pill is the most obvious. That's all hormonal. It's already part of the woman. It does not interfere at all, and there's certainly no wasting of seed in that. So pills, birth control pills would be one preferred way of one preferred birth control to use. A second one that is also allowed is an IUD. Most rabbis are leaning on this for the same reason. We'll get to the concerns about how that can affect a woman's body. Something called the NuvaRing is a form of birth control. It's like a little jelly round thing that actually the woman inserts herself that actually gives off hormones in her body. Last week, Dr. Elman gave a great explanation of all of this. And that also is hormones going into her body. And so like the pill, the NuvaRing would also be allowed. There is a halachic concern with the NuvaRing that many poskim will say it could be a chatzitza for the woman when she's actually using the mikvah. A chatzitza is anything that comes between the woman's body and the water. When a woman immerses in the mikvah, there should be nothing unnatural on her. Anything that's not a part of her body has to be removed. So anything that would be on her body that would come between her and the water is called a chatzitza. Some poskim say that the NuvaRing, or many poskim say that the NuvaRing is a chatzitza and would need to be removed. As we learned from Dr. Elman last week, removing the NuvaRing for a short amount of time is okay and would still be effective. Other poskim have a concern about the NuvaRing during bedikot. If someone is using the NuvaRing, it would be appropriate to ask how she should handle it for her bedikot. Some would say it need to be removed for her bedikot as well. As far as using spermicide as birth control, we can definitely assume that it does not interfere with the natural way of intercourse, so therefore it is okay to be used. Again, with that, talk to your doctor about the effectiveness of it. It definitely has a lower rate of effectiveness as birth control. Another form of birth control called the diaphragm. Again, last week she showed us what it is. It does act as a barrier, so therefore it has some more halachic concerns. If someone found that this was her only option, it would be appropriate to call a rav and ask a shaila about that. Those are the main ones that are considered most acceptable. Those are the main ones that we use. It is important to note that in extremely extenuating circumstances, with rabbinic consultation, there are very, very extreme cases where a condom would be okay or the morning after pill. This is not standard at all, but in extenuating circumstances such as, God forbid, someone is going through chemo or other things that do come up in life, we call them extenuating circumstances. It's appropriate to call a rav and find out what would be appropriate. Second consideration when considering birth control, so that's the halachic side of what is allowed halachically. Of course, the second side that a woman would be concerned with about birth control is how her body is going to react to it and what does she have to be concerned about. So this is familiar to any woman or could become familiar to any woman who is on birth control, that when a woman takes pills, the doctors will always tell us the first few months she might see some staining. Clearly, if a woman sees some staining, which is not her full flow, that could be a NIDA question. One of the other college teachers will be addressing staining in a little bit and how a woman should handle it, but important to know, pills could cause staining either in the first few months on a new pill, changing to a new pill, often on the progesterone pill, women will be staining. The progesterone is called the mini pill, which is the nursing pill. Often there's a lot of staining on that. So certainly, if a woman is on a birth control pill or even on the NuvaRing where there is with hormones that are causing staining, she will become very well versed in the halachot of staining because she will call someone to make sure she knows them. What is not supposed to happen, what is really not supposed to happen, and we'll get to this in staining, is no woman should ever assume that staining makes her Nida without understanding which parts of staining will make a woman Nida. Saying it's just easier to put myself in Nida is not appropriate. I've made the joke all the time. It's like saying I'm keeping Shabbos on Tuesday because I'm tired. There is no value in doing Shabbos on Tuesday. There's no value in becoming a Nida when you're not a Nida. Sorry, I went into staining. It happens a lot. Okay. So that's the concern about the pill and the NuvaRing. The other thing that comes up when going in the pill, which is actually a benefit, a halachic benefit, nice to hear about those, is that if a woman is taking a birth control pill monthly, and during her week of placebos, she sees that she is always getting her period the exact same day on her placebo pills. As women who are keeping the calendar, which is something I would be happy to help anyone figure out, are reminding us that there are those days, they're called our calendar days, or in Hebrew, our veset days. Those are the days a woman will be anticipating her next period. So there are 3 days that we keep. I'm not going to go through them right now, or I will briefly because I'm so tempted. They are basically, they're called the Benonit day, the 30th day after her previous period. The 30th day from that is a day she and her husband would separate from intercourse. The Hachodesh day, which is the exact Hebrew date of the beginning of her previous period, they would separate. And something called the Haflaga, which is the interval between her 2 previous periods, she would count those days and separate on that day as well. I am happy to give a private tutorial on those days. However, there are mechanisms by which a woman does not have to keep all 3 of those days. If she becomes regular and sees it every single month for 3 months in a row, she gets it on the 30th day. After 3 months of seeing the 30th day, she only needs to wait on day 30. She doesn't need to watch and separate on the other 2 days. That can happen for Haflaga, for the interval, and that can happen for the Hebrew date as well. If a woman is taking a pill and she is literally getting her period every 28 days, she's going to know she needs to expect her period on the 28th day only. After 3 months of seeing the 28th day, she will only have to separate the 20th day. I'm not going to talk more about that. I already spoke too much about that. And the flip side is there is one more thing. There's also the opinion that, according to Rav Ovadia and many other poskim, that if a woman is on the pill and she knows that she will be getting her period during the placebos, there is a new medical reality that exists nowadays because so many women have taken the pill over the years that we now know this is reality, and she can rely on that medical reality that her period comes during the placebos. So separate from all those other 3 days that I mentioned, if a woman knows she gets her period on the 3rd day after she starts taking her placebos, whether or not that's the exact same day calculation, she's allowed to rely on that, that is when she gets her placebos. Again, she has to take time to establish this within her cycle, and she also, it is definitely advised that for the 24 hours before that expected time, that she and her husband refrain from intercourse. And the last thing, very briefly to discuss about birth control, a question that could come up is when talking about the IUD now. Believe it or not, we finished pills. That was a very fast thing about pills. The IUD, one of the most common questions that come up is, does inserting the IUD cause Nida? So the answer is the insertion of the IUD does not cause Nida. The opening is small enough that it does not cause Nida. However, after the IUD is inserted, the staining, the pattern of the period, whatever her body is going to do to react to that new IUD that has been put in her, would be worth asking about to figure out how to handle it. Whether or not it's simply staining or whether or not it turns into her flow would be something that is that judgment is made.
Not for us necessarily, but
I don't think it's for us. I think they do that medically speaking and
right.
How that
just
works
like
out well for us. Right.
It's hard to design the key if you do that.
Right.
So I want you to get to the mikvah one time before they.
So that is where, and there are ways. There are ways to get through Sheva Nikiyam even if we're having some staining. I'm going to leave that to the staining person. And that's it for the question. Now, if you call the hotline, I would not keep you on for that half hour. I would say specifically, what have you tried? What has worked for you? What are you leaning towards? And the most important part, which I forgot to say, is any decision about birth control or any medical decision, as important as it is to get the halachic point of view, it goes without saying that the medical point of view would be essential to the halachic psak. So as far as birth control goes, whatever your doctor is going to recommend that is good for your body, that is going to work for you, that is going to be appropriate for your medical situation, would of course be essential to the halachic psak as well. That's it for question number one.
If there are any questions throughout, just feel free to raise your hand. If you want to, you can use the index cards and we can ask them later, but you can feel free to, you know, ask in the meantime.
Yeah. I don't know if this is in the realm, but how permissive are rabbis in Chicago about giving women hunters for birth control?
That's a good question.
That's a great question. We'd have to ask them.
If you go and you say, okay, I have three kids, I'm done, that's it.
So I think it depends on the woman, and it depends on the family situation, and it depends on a lot of different factors that each rabbi, you know, takes into account. I would have to ask many questions. I don't know that anyone's ever done a study on, you know, the rabbis in Chicago in general, and there are also many different kinds of rabbis in Chicago who would probably have different answers to that question. But I would say that it would be very heavily based on the woman herself and her family scenario and her psychological readiness to have another child right now and other things as well. Right? Anything to add? Okay, I'll go next with the next question. Hi, I've been spotting for several days now, but I haven't become a Nida because at first I saw it in colored underwear, and then I put on a panty liner, which, as hopefully Nachama will explain, is not makabal tuma according to most poskim, and therefore would not render a woman a Nida. But today I noticed that the staining got a little bit heavier. How do I tell the difference between a stain and a real flow? In other words, when do I become a Nida? How do I differentiate between, oh, I'm just staining, and, oh, this is now my period, especially if it's just continuous, kind of. The answer that I would give is, this answer is actually not necessarily the answer that I would give on the hotline because I wanted to go through a little bit more background, but I think that there's room to say that different poskim hold differently. Personally, when I teach kalas, I like to give them all the answers, so this way they can kind of like grab onto whatever makes sense to them at that time, and I guess for women throughout stages of life, I think it's appropriate anyway. Rav Willig holds that when a woman saturates a pad, that would, you know, basically tell her that she's no longer staining and that she has obviously begun her flow. Rav Sabalowski holds a little bit differently. He says when a woman feels that she has to start wearing a pad or a tampon, right, that the light days aren't enough or that she's changing her light days like really, really often. You can't just change your light days every 5 minutes and say, oh, you know, I'm still staining. So when a woman feels that she really needs to now start inserting that tampon or wearing that pad, that would be halachically considered to be the beginning of her flow. Others, and, you know, again, sometimes one's more relevant to the other than the other depending on what situation we're in. Others say when you see enough blood, you know, let's say on your underwear or on a light days, that would be the size of a dollar bill folded in half, then that has kind of left the realm of just staining and entered into the realm of a flow. Those are kind of like the three different criteria that I think are pretty prevalent among the YU community, at least, meaning amongst the YU Rosh Yeshiva. In terms of what about when someone has a flow that's much lighter. Either naturally, some women just get a very light period, or very often hormonally, either the pill makes our period a little bit lighter, especially when we have, you know, that pack that Dr. Ellman showed us last week that only contains 4 placebos, and then automatically we, you know, the woman goes back onto the next pill, or the IUD. Some women also, you know, stain sometimes, but they kind of stain monthly. What do we do with that? And so, again, this is a question to ask your individual rabbi, but many poskim hold that if your monthly flow is light and might have in another point in your life been just a stain, but right now you know it's coming about a month after your last period, it's about the same heaviness as your last one was on this pill or, you know, on the IUD or whatever it is, then a woman should assume that it has become a flow and she would be rendered a Nida. Meaning that if the hormones make our flow much lighter than normal, but we know that it's our normal monthly flow, then it would still be, we can't just get away with considering it staining when it's lasting 5 or 6 days every single month, or even every 2 months, you know, or 3 months, but if it's pretty regular, then we have to be sensitive to that, that it's not only the amount, it's also sometimes the frequency with which it occurs. Yeah.
I have a question about that.
Sure.
Let's say a woman is on a medication that stops ovulation.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, regardless of the amount that she's seeing, it's kind of impossible. Wouldn't it be impossible that it's
right? I know. Period? Right. I know that. I mean, again, I'm not a doctor, and okay. I never got any medical background. But I believe that the pill actually stops ovulation, and yet, and still, doctors consider the monthly bleeding on the pill to be a woman's period, even though technically it's not due to ovulation, it is considered to be medically.
Dr. Ullman explained last week that your lining still does build up, even though there's no egg, and it's uterine blood that actually is coming out. So I think that it is considered.
So that's true with the mini pill and the regular pill?
Yes. Yes. Because especially, yes, absolutely. So it's both medically and halakhically still considered to be a woman's period. Very good question.
Okay. Question number 3. I'm not expecting my period. I found a bright, small, reddish pink stain on my underwear. Am I Anita? I would say questions about staining is probably the majority of questions any rabbi gets about Tahara Mishpacha, and probably a lot of them could be answered by ourselves if we know what we're about to say, okay? So the reason that we talk about the difference between a stain and a flow is because from the Torah, Mida Oraita, any flow makes you Anita. No matter where you see it, when you see it, what you see it on, how heavy or light it is, any flow or period is going to make you Anita. On the flip side, only certain kinds of stains will make you Anita, okay? In order for a stain to make you Anita, it has to have all 5 of the following criteria. If it has 4 or 4.5 or 4 3/4, it does not make you Anita, okay? So this is like very important to understand because a lot of our questions come from this, and if we understand it ourselves, then we actually don't even have to ask the question because unless all 5 of these exist, we do not become Anita from a stain, okay? So number 1 is you have to see it, okay? If you didn't see it or you didn't look at it, it doesn't exist. It's kind of like my kids when they knock something over and they look the other way and they may pretend they didn't see it. It's not mine. It's not my mess. I don't have to clean it up. It's the same thing. It actually works for this. We're going to talk in a minute about why it's not cheating, okay? But if you don't see it, you don't have to worry about what might have been there, what could have been there, what I missed, what I didn't look at. If you don't see it, it doesn't get all 5 criteria, okay? That's number 1. Number 2 is the size of the stain. Let's say you did see it. The size of the stain needs to be larger than a U.S. penny, okay? The reasoning for that goes back to the time when there were bed bugs, but we don't have to talk about that. So it has to be larger than a U.S. penny in order for it to be problematic. So if every other criteria is met, but it is smaller than a dime or it is a speck of bright red, it does not make you Anita because it needs to be larger than the size of or larger than a U.S. penny. That's number 2. Okay, number 3 is it needs to fall on a white object or garment. If it falls on any other color, it does not make us Anita if it is just a stain. Because of that, I'm sure many of us have heard that we never ever wear white underwear unless it is our 7 clean days, okay? Because if we're always wearing purple underwear or green or yellow, whatever your color is, or a mix of them, then it will never fall, except on your 7 clean days, on colored underwear. And once you take out that criteria, we don't have to worry about anything else because we didn't meet all 5. Okay? So that's number 3. Number 4 is the color of the stain. Okay? Assuming all the other ones were met, the color of the stain, if it is a white or yellowish, or hopefully not, but greenish, then it is not a problematic color, okay? The reds, red and black is usually problematic, and then browns and pinks are the questionable colors, okay? And those are areas that we would ask a question. We would typically ask a rav. We can drop it off anonymously. The hotline actually does have a system for dropping off marot. There's a box in the back of the CRC. You can drop it off. You call the hotline, tell them you want to drop something off. How do I label it? And then we'll give you a number of what number you were up to for the day, and you can drop it in the CRC box in the back. And then we call the rabbi, tell them to check it. They call us, and we call you. You never have to speak to a man. You never have to see a man. You never have to talk to anybody except for an anonymous one of us nice ladies on the phone. Okay, so that's if the color...
Or email.
Or web form, anything. That's if the color is a questionable color, which again is going to be the reds and blacks. Sometimes they look red and black when they come out, and then you give them a little time to dry. We only look at them when they're dry, and they don't look quite as bad as they did when they first come out, so that's something we keep in mind also. The last criteria is a little bit of a complicated one, but it actually works to our advantage, and that is that it needs to fall on a garment or a material that is mekabel tuma, that accepts impurity. okay? It's a very complicated Beit HaMikdash type of concept, but what it actually means for us is that any natural fiber material, it needs to fall on. So if you are wearing white cotton underwear and a big, bright red stain that you looked at falls on it, bigger than the size of a penny, you have just met every criteria. But if you are wiping yourself with toilet paper, I'm sorry to be so graphic, toilet paper is not a natural fiber. So most rabbis will be lenient that if you see something on toilet paper, no matter how large, what color, all the other criteria, it actually will not make you anida because that is the fifth criteria, that it needs to fall on a natural fiber, a cotton, any other natural fiber. I don't recommend wearing nylon underwear or anything like that, but that anything that is not natural would give us an opening to say, okay, this stain is not a nida stain. So again, all five of these need to be met. I'm just quickly going to talk about why this isn't cheating, okay? Because it really feels like it's cheating, and a lot of us have a hard time with it. Because we said that from a Torah perspective, the only thing that actually makes us nida is our period or our flow. The rabbis, just like all other areas of halacha, want to protect that and make sure we don't get to a situation that we're together with our husband during nida. So they created a situation where some stains are going to make us inida, stains that meet these five categories. Because the rabbis created this halacha, they get to create what the guidelines of the halacha are. Okay, Tammy last week mentioned this, and she mentioned that, you know, in the Torah it says, "Lo tivashel gdi b'chalev imao." Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, okay? But the rabbis decided that any mix of meat and milk is not okay. So they also created this halacha that if I have a huge pot of chicken soup and one tiny drop of milk falls in, it's fine. Now, I think that's cheating. There's actually milk in my chicken soup. Why are you telling me that that's okay? It can't be okay. There's real milk. It's real milk. You know, how can it be? And the answer is because that's not the biblical commandment. The biblical commandment is cooking the kid in the mother's milk. Because they created this idea that all mixes of meat and milk are not okay, they also created exceptions when that doesn't count. Like a drop of milk in your pot of chicken soup, 1 to 60 is going to be null and not count. So it's the exact same thing. Most of us would be fine if we called the rabbi and he said, oh, your milchik spoon in your fleshik pot is fine. We're like, okay, great. We go on. But for some reason, we feel like we're cheating when it comes to not looking or a stain that's smaller than the size of our penny or whatever. And it's actually the same exact reasoning that if the rabbis created the rabbinic halacha, then they can create the guidelines of when that applies and how that halacha should look. Any questions? Yes.
I'm trying to merge with two of you just.
Yes.
I should probably put on a pad because I need to, but I'm wearing colored underwear, so I can just let it go, right, as long as I want, because according to you, it's on purple, so...
Right, so that's where the difference...
That's the question, when does a stain become a flow? That's exactly what Lynn answered. At what point does this not work anymore? At what point does the five categories of a stain not determine whether you're in need or not, and this is really my period... That's what Lynn says. At the point that you feel that if you were, like, staying home, you would put a tampon in, or anything else Lynn said, a stain larger than a folded dollar bill, or saturating a pad, that's when you can wear purple from today till tomorrow. It's not going to help you, okay? Because it's no longer in the category of stain. It then becomes in the category of flow. Does that make sense?
Good question. Thanks, Rob.
Yes.
Does the fiber of a pantry liner constitute also that in the comment tumor?
Yes. According to many poskim, okay, to make sure that that's not an issue, the mikvah sells black panty liner, so you don't have to look. But if you were to ask many, if let's say it happened or you didn't have another color panty liner and you wore a white panty liner, many rabbis would say that it does not make you a nida if you have a big red stain on it for exactly the same reason. Yes?
What about a stain during your 7 clean days on white underwear, but it doesn't make it, it's smaller than a penny?
Doesn't count. You're
great
fine.
Question.
Good question.
Great
only
question.
On
the
cloth, only on something that goes internal, right. On a batika cloth. But if it comes out of you and it's smaller than a penny, then
even
it...
Even on white cotton underwear. Yes.
There is an element, and I think we all answer this also, but just to rephrase it, there's an element that if a woman has her period and she looks away and changes her liner every day, it doesn't count.
Hour.
There's an element of a woman knowing the difference between her real flow and the staining. It's that gray zone that is challenging for every woman, and it's even challenging somewhat for halacha of when does the stain, you know, we always ask, what's the difference between a light period and heavy staining? Every woman knows it's the exact same thing. So it is a challenge halachically to figure it out, but that's why so many of the phone calls are about this, and these nuances will help differentiate between what is considered something that will make a woman anita and what is not. So if a woman saw tons of bright red on toilet paper, it would be appropriate to call. It's a judgment call and there are halachic nuances of it, but if it was, first of all, if it's bright red on toilet paper, you're not expecting to appear, call your doctor. That's awesome, okay? Always call your doctor. But after you call the doctor and find out that you are okay medically, then, there is an element of what you feel you have a question about. It is always appropriate to call and ask. I remember I once asked a rub, what is the difference between the light period and the light period and the heavy stain? He's like, well, if I knew that, I'd be a very rich man. You know, like the point is, this is a halachic area that has an answer for us as the women doing it, but it's appropriate that it sometimes feels
And even
confusing.
If you came tonight, you are more than welcome to call the hotline and ask us this again, because it is confusing, but we're just trying to empower you to minimize questions that
sometimes
you have.
Sometimes when you're doing two packs of pills back-to-back, like if you're staining at some point, like maybe it's not in between, but maybe like halfway through the second pack, can you, since you're not expecting your period, if you're on colored underwear, but there's still blood on the toilet paper, but it's bigger than a penny, but can you ignore it?
So I think, again, that goes back to the question of what's the difference between staining and a flow. So you're right, the criteria here won't be, well, what is my normal time to get my period? Because it's not exactly the normal, nothing's normal right now. But the criteria might be the amount of blood. So if it's the size of a dollar bill folded in half, if you feel that you really need a pad or a tampon, that the light days isn't doing the trick, then that would be considered a flow. But if it's on a, you know, you could wear your light days the entire day and even through the night and it's no problem, then that's still staining. It kind of depends on how much blood as opposed to when you're getting it and when you're seeing it.
There is an element of we do kind of, I don't want to say we pick and choose, but I will say there is a balance between what we know medically helping us and what we know medically not helping us. So, like, even though in that case we might know it's uterine staining, that's true. We know that medically this is something we're seeing and we think it's coming from the uterus. That makes sense. So we once heard, once when we were in a session, Rav Schwartz once said, he's like, we don't argue with the mitzvah, it's the reality that it is dam. We know it is dam. But certain dam, certain blood will not render a woman anita. So this is a point where we might know what it is medically, but halacha will have a different commentary on it. And it's a delicate balance between the two, which is why there is a hotline, because if it was so easy, we wouldn't need it.
What if, like, you double up on your pills or the ring or you have an IUD where you don't get your period for, like, a long time? How are you supposed to figure out, like, when you're supposed to stay away from your husband, stuff like that?
Excellent question. Okay. Excellent question.
Do you have to? Or
you do the first month. And then you're done. You do the first, whenever the last time was that you had your period, you wait the 30th day, the Benoni, which is 30 days from the first day of your period, the Hachodesh, which is the same Hebrew date as the first day of your previous period, and your Haflaga, which is the interval, whatever it was. And I think according to most, that's it. You just do that once, and then
you're good to go until you get the next one. But then you might want to keep in mind, because then your Haflaga might be really, really long, but it might come into play the next time as well. So if it was a 90-day interval,
right,
you might want to mark your calendar for 90 days later to make sure that you keep the same one, right? Is that, yeah.
Yeah.
If a woman is experiencing menstrual symptoms along with staining or flow or whatever, like, you know, she's trying, whatever, sometimes I'll talk to a rabbi about, you know, whatever I'm seeing, and then he'll say, like, are you having any symptoms? And I'm wondering, what is he getting at when he asks that? Like, is he trying to figure out if it's a flow?
Yes.
If there are symptoms, is that a flow?
Yeah.
He's deciding if tomorrow you're going to get your period, and today you're just at the beginning of your period. Right?
Right, because there's a difference between staining mid-cycle and staining that precedes our period.
So would any symptoms be an indication that it's a flow?
Not necessarily.
Potentially.
Not at that moment.
But that's why they're asking.
Okay.
Not at the moment. And they might say, let's wait and see tomorrow. Right. If you're experiencing symptoms that your period is coming, they might say, you know, let's wait and see what happens tomorrow, which means at the moment you're not anita. they might advise to hold off on relations that night. Some post-game hold 24 hours, but they'll say, let's wait and see what happens tomorrow. They're not going to say, let's wait and see what happens for a whole week. They're going to say, let's wait and see what happens because you're experiencing the menstrual. But the concept that some of like hargusha, which is like this internal feeling of doria, that's not what they're getting at. They're using, and if that doesn't sound familiar, don't worry about it. But if it's something that is just to help indicate what that staining might be.
Also, as Lynn mentioned, you know, being on different in different cycles of life or being on different pills, like your regular period could become one of these lighter periods, which if that becomes your usual period at that stage of life, it might be considered to be a flow, in which case it would be NIDA. So having symptoms could indicate that they would be one of those type of things as opposed to like just a light staining or something. So it could be that that's why they're asking to try to figure out, well, is this your new flow or is this just a stain that we can try to ignore? Is there another question? Yeah.
Can you clarify? I think somebody asked about if there's a stain mid-cycle on white underwear but during 7 clean days, that does not make you a NIDA.
Depending on
what was the question?
A stain on white underwear.
I guess it has to fall under the same.
Right. The question was if it's smaller than a penny, but it's during your 7 clean days on white underwear, would it make you a NIDA? And the answer is no. The same stain rules apply. As long as it's not on a Badika cloth or a tampon that goes internal.
Which
a Badika cloth and a tampon that goes internal, Lynn will tell you like anything
why
counts.
That's different.
But even during your 7 clean days, if it fall and you're wearing white underwear, if it's smaller than a penny or any of the other criteria don't apply, then you're not in NIDA.
Because remember, the white and cotton are 2 of 5 criteria. So even though you are definitely meeting 2 of those criteria during Zion Nikim, because you have to, and that's the point, we want to catch any blood to make sure that we're going to the mikvah with purity, as long as the other 3 are not fulfilled, then you're fine. And so it might be a good idea, sometimes we recommend often, if you find that a stain is really close to that penny, it's not yet there, change your underwear, get a new pair, because you can prevent it from becoming the size of a penny if you, now, like, don't change it every second, then obviously there might be a real problem. You just, if you're going through your Zion Nikim after your period and you're getting that much blood, and if you're on hormones, that might explain it. If not, you might want to speak to your doctor. But if it's the kind of thing that, like, every few hours or some one day, or the first or second day, you know, that might be helpful to change your underwear. Yeah.
So what if you have, like, a stain, and then, like, it's smaller than the amount and everything, but then you have another one, so do you put them together, like, one stain?
Very good question. If they're connected, then they have to be looked at together. But if they're not connected, then they're looked at separately. So if they're in 2 different pairs of underwear, totally fine. Even if they're 2 separate stains on 1 pair of underwear, as long as they're not connected in any way, shape, or form, they're considered 2 separate stains. Even if you know they happen separately because you saw one earlier and now you just saw one now, but they're connected, which is unfortunate. I mean, it's likely because it's coming from the same area of our body. If they're connected on the underwear or anywhere else, then they are looked at together. Very good question.
Only the red part.
I was just going to say
but only the red part of it.
Right.
So if the stain is like reddish, brownish, mixture of different colors, the rub who looks at it or when you're looking at it to see, you would only be adding up the connected red parts.
Right. If there's something that's obviously brownish, yellowish, whitish, then that doesn't count.
And that's only on a garment. On your body, if you found on your leg a stain, a blood side stain, everything is connected, whether it's touching or not. They're all, like, it's the sum of all the parts has to be less than a penny if it's on your body.
And forgive me for being a little graphic, a woman is experiencing hemorrhoids or she had a bowel movement that was challenging, if after using the bathroom in those situations and she sees blood but she knows where it came from, she doesn't have to be concerned because she happens to be in the bathroom area and she saw blood, that is a shiloh. She knows exactly where it comes from or the source of it. It's similar to saying, I have a mosquito bite on my inner leg and there's blood there. Do I have to be concerned? No, you know where the blood came from. So that's just a question that comes up often. We feel like any blood on toilet paper we're concerned with. If we know the source of it, I mean, we should be certain about the source of it, but if we are certain about the source of it, then that would be okay for her to make that judgment.
Yeah.
And then can I ask like a specific question? Sure. Like, after you have a baby, how do you know when to start the clean days? Like, if there's stains that are not, let's say they're like brown or something.
Excellent question.
Yeah, who's doing those?
Excellent question.
Oh, yeah,
it's one of the most common questions we get.
Postpartum is difficult because every woman's different. Every woman experiences it differently, and every woman might even experience it differently in each postpartum scenario she's in. And therefore, you know, when the doctor schedules a 6-week postpartum checkup, that is usually when most women will have stopped bleeding, and that's why she can get the go-ahead to resume relations with her husband, because usually things have repaired themselves. But sometimes with heavy lifting, I know my mom always told me when I was moving, like, don't do heavy lifting, it's going to make you bleed more, don't exercise. I don't know how much of that is bovomycin, how much of that is medical, but at the, you know, every woman bleeds differently. And so I know that I was told, when you stop bleeding, just wait, because it will probably resume. So postpartum women can stop and then start and then stop and then start. And so in order for a woman to be emotionally a little calmer, it might be helpful not to start as soon as she stops seeing the blood. It might be helpful to just wait a little bit to make sure it's not going to come back. Because for some women, starting those Zynekeem and getting 3 clean days and clean bodicas and then seeing a bright, huge red stain on the 4th day would be just disheartening and challenging and hard to move on from. And we're all hormonal at that point. And, you know, so sometimes it's just easier to wait a few more days or a few more hours. After you've had a, you know, 1, 2, 3 babies, and you've kind of gotten, you know, the sense of what your body does, if your body gives you that sense, then you might know better. But certainly after, you know, some women find that they stop bleeding after 3 weeks, but more common, I would say, is in the 4, 5, 6, maybe even 7-week range. And I would wait, you know, recommend to wait a little bit before just automatically starting your Zynekeem. But with the knowledge that even after you get 5 clean days, you might see blood again. And as long as that's part of our mentality and part of our expectation, it's less likely to be as disappointing as it would be if we thought we were, you know, really, really ready. But the answer is we don't know.
But,
yes, please.
No, but also just in terms of your question being like the brown staining and stuff, you don't have to wait until you're totally not seeing anything, because brown could be really fine. So if a woman is seeing that she's really stopped her heavy bleeding, she stopped even her light reddish bleeding, and it's really just a lot of this brown staining for, you know, days, of like a week even on end, then she might want to start trying. And also, again, with the mentality of, let's try, let's see what happens. If I can get through it, great. If not, you know, whatever. Because, again, once you've got into the mikvah, you can wear colored underwear and not look at those brown stains, and it won't be an issue anymore. So it's kind of like a balance between not wanting to rush into it to devastate emotionally yourself about it, or to harm yourself even more, or, you know, interfere with any of the body's healing. But definitely does not have to wait until it's totally, you know, clean. It could still just be brown. And that would be something where, if brown is not a color that you're used to seeing and used to getting the okay ready from a rub about, then that would be something you would probably want to bring in to ask and say, is this brown an okay color? If I see this brown tomorrow, can I assume it's fine? Do I still have to bring it in? And a rub might tell you, this, if you see this color, you're fine. You can see it every day and you'll be fine. Or they might say, you know what, it's fine. If you see it again, bring it in again and we'll see tomorrow what's going to happen. Does that answer?
And okay, one more thing about it, that it also depends if a woman is nursing or not nursing, what pill she's on, what pill she's not on. So it's also a really good idea. We've gotten a question about, you know, I'm ready to go to the mikvah and I'm just going to start my pill today. Well, first of all, you want to talk to the doctor about how effective that will be. And also, doctors will often tell us beginning of pills will have some staining. So it's a great idea. And I actually double-checked with Dr. Ellman last week. I'm like, is it appropriate for women to ask you in the delivery room for birth control for afterwards? She says, absolutely. So you don't have to do it in the delivery room, but certainly in those visits in the hospital while you are, please God, healing, it is okay to ask and to start up your plan. Again, we're tired and a little out of it, but if you are able to have the frame of mind, that is an appropriate time to ask about it, as opposed to waiting until the day you're going to the mikvah. So that all plays into it also. The staining.
Okay. We'll move on. If anyone has any questions, feel free to raise your hand.
I just want to point out that's why most of the questions on the hotline are about staining. That was a perfect example of how that works.
Okay. I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but I think it's a question I have to ask. So thank you for letting me be anonymous. My husband and I had sex last night, and after he came out, he saw blood on his penis. Am I Anita? And, okay, so this is, first of all, thank you so much for asking. This is a real question, and it's a good question. And sometimes the anonymity makes us feel a little more comfortable, but a rabbi would be okay with getting the question as well. I'm going to, in this case, explain a little bit of the background, especially based on what we were talking about the staining and the seam and the size and everything like that, and explain why in certain situations things are a little bit different. In order to become a Nida Midoraita, Nechama already explained, we need to have a flow. In fact, the Gemara tells us that even before we get to the flow, which is true, but even before we get to the flow, we need to have something called a hargasha. What is that? So translating it means a feeling, but a feeling of what? And this is already a machloket parshanim. Some say it's this tremor in the body. Others say it's the feeling that our uterus is opening. And yet others say it's the feeling of something, of a blood or something liquid leaving our uterus, but not what we feel today as in like, oh, my vaginal canal feels a little wet, I feel like I'm getting a stain. No, it's actually leaving the uterus, like going through the cervix. Most women today, and like really, really a major majority of women today, do not feel a hargasha as they've been interpreted. And that's why today, midoraita, we need a flow, because Chazal assumed that even though we don't necessarily feel a hargasha today, if we see a flow, we must have had one, and we're just not, let's say, as in tune with our bodies as they used to be, and we didn't sense it, we didn't feel it. And so today, hargasha is, for the major majority of women, not indicative of, well, we don't really feel it, so therefore, when we get a flow, we assume the hargasha happened, and we are in nida midoraita. However, there are three different scenarios that we can be in that might mask a hargasha. Any time that we're actually involved or we're doing something in our vaginal canal, we could potentially have had a hargasha, but because we were doing something, we got distracted from it and didn't sense it. And so those are what Kala teachers like to call suffake hargasha activities. There's a doubt whether or not we felt a hargasha because we were doing something else in the very same area which could have masked it. And therefore we have to assume that any blood we see would have or could have been associated with a hargasha, therefore rendering us nida mida oraita. And because this is a suffake deoraita, we're machmir, right? It's like kind of like with brachot, suffake deoraita lehachmir, suffake derabanan lehakel, right? When we're not sure about a derabanan, the rabbi said it's okay. But when we're not sure about something from the Torah, we want to make sure that we're keeping everything from the Torah. What are those three suffake hargasha activities? So one is going to the bathroom. Again, we're doing something in that area. Two is doing a bedika, because we're inserting our finger with a bedika cloth around it in that area. And that's why the kulas, right, the leniencies of the size being, you know, having to be greater than a gris, that doesn't apply. Any teeny tiny little dot that appears on our bedika cloth, because it could have been associated with the hargasha, it could render us nida mido oraita, nida from the Torah, and therefore we have to assume that it's problematic regardless of the size. Which is why there's a very big difference between what comes out, what we see in our bedika cloth, and what we see in our underwear, in which case there is no suffake hargasha, so we apply all of those leniencies. And then the last scenario where we have a suffake hargasha activity where we're not really sure because we were involved down there is during intercourse. And that is the basic background for what the answer, what the psak will be in this scenario, in that if, you know, his body was inside of her, and then when he comes out, he sees a drop of blood, we know where it came from. And because it was in that area, it's a suffake hargasha activity, and therefore no matter what size the stain is that he sees, she would be considered anida. A tip or a piece of advice would be to keep a colored towel nearby, in a night table or under the bed or any place that is convenient, and that your husband should be wiping himself off with that colored towel after every single time you're together, so that will likely not happen. Because again, what you don't see doesn't matter, and if you only see it later on color, then it's fine. So that would be a nice tip to help prevent this from happening in the future.
Questions?
Okay. So now we will be moving on to questions.
Question.
Yes.
Question.
Sure. Absolutely.
Can you talk about any need for harchosos or bedikas with staining?
Yes. If the stain renders a woman anida, then she would be anida and have to keep everything. If it does not render a woman anida, then she would not. However, if it is likely to be preceding her period, then many rabbis recommend holding off on intercourse until they know, you know, like Tammy said, either 24 hours or until the next day to see what happens. But that would not necessitate harchakot to be kept, just holding off of bia itself. Very good question. There is no reason to do a bedika other than when someone is already anida during Zayin Nikiyim, or if she has to do a bedika for her veset, which is according to many that are abundant, we ask only required if she wants to have intercourse with her husband afterwards and after the onabinonit, which is the 30th day from her period. So that would be the only time that a woman would be doing a bedika when she is not already a nida. There is no need to do a bedika at any other point other than her zayin nikiyah when she's already a nida, or like I said, during vestot, according to the rabbanan, we ask at the hotline, that's only really one of those vestot, only one of those calendar days. According to some others, it would be all three. Depends on who you ask.
I have often been asked, I am staining. I did a bedika to see what was going on. Do not do a bedika to see what's going on. Wait and let your body show you what is going on, because like Lynn said, anything that we see on a bedika cloth will be more problematic. It's harder to be makel on something or a stain that is seen on a bedika cloth. So do not do a bedika unless, like, and I'm just reiterating it because it comes up a lot, and because we are always so careful about wanting to do this mitzvah just right, a bedika is not always the answer. Sometimes it is, but you're going to learn exactly. We're learning exactly one. Hey, that's a great entrance to my topic.
I just want to clarify. So the answer to your question is, yes, you are a nida?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Automatically.
Yes, automatically.
Okay. Yes. If he saw it on himself or white.
If he saw it on himself, could be on any part of his body that was inside of you, but if he sees it on a part of his body that was not inside of you, then that would not render a woman a nida. And a shayla might have to be asked at that point, but that's not automatic.
What about a wet tissue?
So, good question. That would be the same as toilet paper, which according to many is not a problem because it's not makabel tumah, but according to some would be, so you'd have to ask your particular rabbi what he holds.
Okay. Speaking about bedika, here's a question, and just the background to this question is that this question was asked on a Friday. You'll hear why that's important. I did a bedika on Tuesday, and I did a bedika on Wednesday, but I'm not sure which one is my day one. I'm trying to start my Sheva Nikiyam. I also forgot to put on white underwear on Wednesday. Am I still in my Sheva Nikiyam? Okay, so this woman asks a lot of questions, which is great. The answer is yes, she is. She is still in her Sheva Nikiyam, and we're going to talk about why. The first bedika that a woman does, either after her 5 days of period have ended or any day after that, that she can get her first clean bedika, that first bedika is called a hefsek tahara. A hefsek tahara is a bedika. They are exact same thing, but it has a special name because it's the first one. So the first one that you do at the end of your 5 days or whatever day your period ends, the day that you can get a clear one, that is called the hefsek tahara. The day after your hefsek tahara is considered day one. Some people like to say the hefsek tahara is done on day zero. The day after that is considered day one. There's a technical reason that basically the Sheva Nikiyam have to be a full 24-hour day. So if you're doing your hefsek tahara, like this woman did on Tuesday, sometime before Shkia, so then as soon as Shkia comes and goes and Seder Kochavim comes and goes, then the next Hebrew date has started, like Shabbos. We light candles at the beginning of Shabbos in the evening because that is the beginning of the Hebrew date. We are obviously working with a Jewish calendar. So when she does her Hefsek Tahara on Tuesday, day zero, the next day, Wednesday, is considered her day one. So she did her Hefsek Tahara on Tuesday. She did her first bedika on day one on Monday. So therefore, that woman was able to get her Sheva Nikiyam started. Once a woman has that Hefsek Tahara and a bedika the next day on day one, that's when her Sheva Nikiyam have started. So this woman was still in. As far as wearing the white underwear, wearing white underwear is definitely a part of the Sheva Nikiyam. However, if a woman forgets to, or for some reason can't, or hasn't gotten to laundry, or isn't at the right place at the right time to put on her white underwear, it would not interrupt her Sheva Nikiyam. She would still be in her Sheva Nikiyam. Again, every effort should be made to be wearing white underwear. It is definitely a part of the Sheva Nikiyam, but it would not interrupt her Sheva Nikiyam if she wasn't. They will continue. Furthermore, in our Sheva Nikiyam, we definitely attempt to do 2 bedikot every day. That is, by most poskim, the standard practice. 2 bedikot every day, only during daylight hours. We take the daylight hours, divide them into AM hours and PM hours, which are morning and
evening, afternoon hours. She'll do one bedika in the morning. She'll do one bedika in the afternoon. Close to Shkia is great, but if she's going to be out driving carpools or at a meeting or to business something and she's not going to be around during Shkia, she could do it at 4 in the afternoon if that's when she'll remember. If she forgot to do it in the morning, she can do it at 10 in the morning. Anytime during those daylight hours, she should attempt to do two, one in the morning hours, one in the afternoon hours. If she misses one of those two bedikot anywhere on days 2 through 6, she can keep going in her count and her shevenikim will continue. However, on day 1 and day 7, which makes sense because it's the first day and the last day, she must have at least one bedika. That is probably the most essential piece of the shevenikim. She must have one bedika on day 1 and at least one bedika on day 7. Missing both bedikot on day 1 or both bedikot on day 7 will alter her shevenikim. It will change the count of her shevenikim. If this were to happen, it'd be appropriate to ask a shayla and figure out how to redo your counting. But of course, every effort should be made to make sure there's a bedika that she has her hefsek tahara, then a bedika on day 1 and a bedika on day 7. Those are the most essential. Like we said before, during our shevenikim, we will be wearing white underwear. According to most poskim, if a woman is still having other types of discharges, yellow, white, clear, and she needs to wear a liner in order to be comfortable during her shevenikim, most poskim will say that's okay. During our shevenikim, we're going to count consciously and we're going to count consecutively. We don't need to sing it out loud, but we in our head need to remember today's day 1, today's day 2, today's day 3, and certainly they have to go in order. It also is very common, or in some communities, or depending on who your teacher was, depending on your rav, using white sheets during shevenikim is still practiced by some people. And just one more interesting point, if you're a math person, you know this already, but for those of us who are not, the day you do your hefsek tahara, a week later will be your mikveh night. It's just how the math works. So when this woman did her hefsek tahara on Tuesday, she did it during the day or Tuesday afternoon before Shkia. Wednesday was her day 1, and she did another bedik in the morning on day 1. So you have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Shabbos, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Tuesday is her 7th day. When Tuesday, the Hebrew date of Tuesday, ends, she will be going to mikvah on Tuesday night. So that's just a helpful hint. The day you do your hefsek, a week later, is your mikvah night.
When
that's
you
it.
Say do a bedik on day 1, so...
What?
You say do a bedik on day 1 and day 7. Let's say you,
well, I said aim to do 2 on every day.
Right.
Go on. Okay, just clarify.
If you do a bedika, a hasakar Sunday, let's say Sunday night, at Shkia.
Before Shkia.
Right, before Shkia.
And we will always correct that.
Right,
I have to tell you, people will say, I did it night, Shkia. I will say, when you say night, did you mean before Shkia? Just clarify. Okay,
right,
always.
So then Sunday night, Monday is day 1. So you do a bedika Monday morning?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly, because the one that was done Sunday before Shkia was the Hefsek Tahara on day 0. When Shkia came, that day ended, and the next Hebrew day started. That was her day 1. So she needed one during the daylight hours of day 1 on Monday. Exactly.
What if you're prone to light brown staining on day 1, 2, 3?
Excellent.
Excellent.
No, absolutely. Do the bedikot. Two things, and like Nechama said earlier, it comes out red. It comes out brown. We see it on the bedika cloth. I cannot tell you how many things have brought in that I have seen that have been red, and they dry, and the rav, quote, I call it like I see it. So when they look at it, and it's not as red anymore, that's the psak. That is what, so to us, we think it's brown. To us, we think it's still red. It is absolutely worth it to not add on those 3 more days to bring it in and get the other judgment. I have heard people said, why don't you teach all the kallahs all the colors? Because then we'd have nobody getting married. Okay, that would be a very uncomfortable kallah class. It is up for every woman to only learn her own colors. That's all we need to know. Our own colors. That's it. That's why we only bring in our own stuff. So if a woman finds that she is staining for her, or has some brown stuff on her bedika cloth for the first 3 days, I don't use this word often, it behooves her to bring it in and have it looked at so that she can have an accurate judgment and that the couple does not have to wait an extra 3 days. No mitzvah, no.
I will say that if a bedika is done on day 1 and it was problematic and the rabbi said it was okay, it's worthwhile, and you know that days 2 and 3 you're probably going to have a problem, you can ask the rabbi, do I have to do one tomorrow? because, like she said, if you skip one on days 2 through 6, it's not going to stop your Zeinikiyim. And so it's not okay to make the decision on one's own, but it's always worth asking, because the rabbis say, you know, skip tomorrow on the next day and then do it day 4 when you know you'll be okay. So that could be an answer. It may not be, but it's always worth asking.
One more important point, and I know there are questions. One more thing I forgot to add, the Hefsek Tahara. Sometimes it's like the end of a woman's period, and you know, she'll do one at 4 o'clock and it'll be red, and then she waits 2 more hours. At 6 o'clock, it'll be a little less red, and then she is at 8. And if she tries again at 8, it'll be clear, or at least light brown, or a color that looks less problematic. For the Hefsek Tahara only, a woman can do as many as she needs, and only the most current one will be valid. So if a woman is trying to get her Hefsek Tahara, and she does 1, it's kind of red, and she does 2, and it's getting lighter. And of course, if she's comfortable physically, because there is less discharge the more bidikot a woman does, of her own natural discharge, if she gets to do Hefsek Tahara number 3, and even though the first 2 cleaned her out, and that's why number 3 was clear, she can use that clear Hefsek Tahara that is valid. That will be her Hefsek to start her Sheva Nikiyim. And what could sometimes happen is, even if the next morning she wakes up and there's a little dot of brown on her underwear, we now know that little dot of brown won't render her Anita. So she was able to start her Sheva Nikiyim. Again, that morning bidika might have brown in it. She'll bring it in and ask a question. But the idea that one can do more than one bidika for the Hefsek Tahara only is an important piece of information, and the most valid one, and the most recent one, is what counts.
And the Hefsek Tahara only has to be a kosher color, like all the bidikas. It does not have to be clear.
Correct.
It just has to be a color that's not problematic.
So many of those browns are okay.
Just, if you could just remind us all, who are the rabbi that you would...
Great question. That's a great question. I think we should all take turns answering that. I guess I started.
What's the question?
Which rabbi, how do you bring it in, and which rabbi bring it in? So talk about the hotline first.
Just, who are the...
Any community rabbis, we will ask for you.
No.
That's
who,
the first thing.
Aren't there a group of
rabbis?
The hotline will ask any rabbi that you ask. The first step is that when you call the hotline, you can request any Orthodox rabbi for us to ask for you, and we will go to any Orthodox rabbi in the Chicagoland community.
Absolutely.
We absolutely have. From the right to the left, we've gone to everybody. And the zip codes that we get from the hotline is from the right to the left. And from out of Chicago, even, which is interesting. Wow. Lots of
some of them are from Chicago.
I mean, some were originally from Chicago who have left, but it's always interesting to hear, you know, you expect the 6 to be the first digit, and it's, you know, somewhere else. We will ask anyone, and we have asked anyone. Rav Schwartz, Hishever Shpushlim, is the official posek of the hotline. And then we will ask anyone throughout. It depends what shul people go to. It depends who they want to go to.
As far as dropping stuff off.
Okay.
That, like you said, the hotline has a box outside the CRC. It's purposely kept privately. It's in the parking lot. If you drive past the CRC building in the parking lot off of Rockwell, there's a little box.
Washtenaw.
It's Washtenaw? Thank you. Mm-hmm. There's a box on the wall. It looks a little bit like a mailbox. There's a little sign next to it and tells you can put it there. Forgive me for saying this. The Brand's house has a box on their fence. Every Rav in the community is expecting items to be dropped off in his mailbox. The way to drop something off, and we've been told this from Rabbanim, they respect the anonymous drop-off, which means you take the item, whether if it's a pair of underwear, cut the underwear, forfeit it, and just send in the part that has the stain. If it's your favorite pair of underwear, we can get it back to you also. But either way, cut it and hand it in, or, okay, you take the part that is needed. You put that, it's nice to put that in a white envelope. Only put it in something that's paper, anything that's plastic, a Ziploc bag. It'll change the color, it'll keep it moist. We want it to air dry. Put it in a white envelope.
We have envelopes outside on the table, by the way, which have everything you need. And if you want to put your name, your phone number to call you back, or your email address, and what day, was it your Hefsek? Was it day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7? Are there any medical questions that we should be aware of? It's all there, so feel free to take a bunch on your way out for future use.
And put it on the envelope. If you don't have one of those handy, then they are great, they're in all the shul bathrooms, you can take one from your house and write on it what it is. Hefsek Tahara, Moch, Bidika morning day 1, Bidika afternoon day 5. Write what it is. The Rav knows what he's looking at. You know, undergarments from mid-cycle, not expecting anything. Write what it is on the white envelope. Then you take that white envelope,
If you don't have one, it's okay, but it's ideal to put it in a brown lunch bag or a jewel bag. But even the brown lunch bag is great because you can write on it. You write the rabbi's name so that his entire family knows it's for him and nobody else takes it. And then just write your number. You do not need to write your name. You do not need to write your name. They are not keeping track and they don't want to know. They just want to get you the halacha. Write your number. Write if it's a cell phone, if you want to be texted back, if you want to be called back, you can write call or text. Of course, if you write call and your voicemail says your name and you don't want them to know who it is, change your voicemail on the machine. But, you know, the idea is it is done with as much discretion as possible. I know Rabbi Shaffel Skokie does it. I know Rabbi Cohn in West Rogers Park does it. I know that, I mean, help me with the list here. I mean, Rabbi Twersky does it. Rabbi Engel does it in Skokie. Rabbi Gelman does it in Skokie. Obviously, I live in Skokie. But, like, Rabbi
Reese
does it.
Just make sure they're home and not on vacation because you don't want to lose your bodega cloth in someone's house and then you won't get an answer for a week.
And if you drop it in the CRC box, you need to call the hotline and just tell us something's there so we tell you how to label it so you get back your information.
Okay, let's move on.
And they're all expected.
Okay. Hi. I need to go to the mikvah, but I will be at work all day until nighttime. When should I take my bath? Okay, so before I give the answer, just because I feel like tonight's a lot about giving information to help empower you to understand what's going on, and be able to make some of these decisions yourself as well. There's two opinions that are both valid that are brought down from the Gemara about when the ideal time to do what's called the chafifa, which is the bath and the prepping and the cleansing and all that lovely soaking we do before we go to the mikvah. So one opinion says that the best time to do it would be right before you're going to be tovel in the mikvah at night, right? You're going to do it because that would make sense because then you're clean and then you don't touch anything, you don't get any chatzitzas on you, you're all good, and you go into the mikvah. The other opinion says, no, if you do it at night, they're concerned the woman's going to rush through this chafifa process because they're so excited to go into the mikvah and get back to their house that they're going to rush and not do it properly. So that opinion says she should start during the daytime so that she has no chance of rushing through it because she can't go to the mikvah anyway until nightfall. So what we like to do, because we like to do this in halacha, we like to make a compromise and say, well, we're going to follow both opinions. We're going to start our bath when it's still daylight hours, right before shkia time, and we're going to continue it until it's time to go into the mikvah, which is at nightfall. So that is lovely, and that is a nice ideal to do, but reality is that many of us are not available at that time of day to be taking a nice 20, 25-minute, half-hour bath and going to the mikvah, whether it's at home or at the mikvah. I mean, in the winter time, this could be at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when you're driving carpools, when you're getting dinner ready. It could be at, you know, it could be at 6 or 7 o'clock later in the season when it's dinner time, bath time, bedtime. So when should we go? So if we're not going to be doing the combination of the two, so many rabbis say that the next best thing to do is to do it close to the tefillah time, close to the actual going to mikvah, which even if it means doing it after nightfall, we try and we really should, if that's going to happen, we should do one thing during the day. So most people give the example of cutting your nails. So anytime during the daylight hours to do something as preparation for going to the mikvah that night, cutting your nails, washing your face. If you don't wear makeup every day and you have makeup on you, taking off your makeup, doing something that's going to start your process. But then a woman could do the rest of her chafifa process at night, being mindful to still spend enough time that she's going to be doing it as sufficiently as she would had she been doing it during the day. If that's still not possible for a woman to do it at night, then she can do it earlier in the daytime. And there are many rabbis who would even allow someone to do it in the morning if that's her only option of when she can do it leisurely. However, using common sense would also make us aware that if I'm going to be taking my bath at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and not going to the mikvah until 9:30 at night, I have to be careful about what I come into contact with from that time until going to the mikvah. And when I get to the mikvah later that night, my shower should probably be a little bit more thorough, as well as my checking and just my prep at the mikvah itself should be more thorough to make sure that I've gotten rid of anything that could have come into contact with my body between the time of taking my bath earlier in the day and going to the mikvah. But the general concept to keep in mind is that we want the woman to be as close to the tefillah time as possible, but keeping in mind that we want it to be done leisurely without compromising the thoroughness of the actual preparations. So sometimes that's a judgment call that has to be made by the woman. If someone finds themselves in a situation where really they can only do it
really early in the morning, maybe you want to ask a question about that. What's the most preferred method? But we want to do it as close to the time we're going to the mikvah, taking care to make sure that we can leisurely take our bath while kids are screaming in the kavel and all that kind of stuff. Any questions on that?
We have three questions left, so we're going to devote about 5 minutes to each, and let's just hold the questions until the end. Okay, the next question is, hi, I have to go to the mikvah Friday night, but I live pretty far from the mikvah. What are my options?
Friday morning.
Okay, so there are a couple of options, okay? The most obvious option is if she lives close enough that she's willing to walk, even though it's a far walk, she can walk there, she can walk back. That's the most obvious option.
Can I just mention something? It's a real sakana to me. On Friday nights, walking back on 2 weeks on the mikvah by myself is scary.
That's why in Skokie, the mikvah lady will meet you and walk with you. Nobody in Skokie walks by themselves. We walk in groups.
I mean, she can walk together.
We're going to get to that. So we should talk about that.
In a while, but like I had to do three friends in a row. I was scared.
We don't like danger.
Okay. Another option that we have is that you can light candles for Shabbos, something called Al Tnai, where you light a few minutes before it's actually Shabbos, and when you light, you verbally say, "I'm not accepting Shabbos until after I drive to the mikvah," or I drive to X, wherever you're driving. You light candles, you drive to the mikvah, then you wait at the mikvah till it's Shabbos, go in the mikvah, and then you would walk home. So you would only have to walk one way, okay? Now, in certain situations, walking at all is not an option. Either you live in a community without a mikvah, or you live in a community that's way too far to go to the mikvah, okay? In these kind of extenuating circumstances, many rabbis will allow women to go late Friday afternoon before Shabbos, okay, and come back only once her husband has left to shul already, okay? This is not something we could decide on our own. It's something you have to ask a rabbi about, but it is a heter that lots of rabbis will give, okay? There is a question of maybe just pushing off from Friday night and go Saturday night instead. Much easier, and it works. So there's a discussion in halacha whether going to the mikvah on mikvah night is a mitzvah itself, and there's value in actually going the night of the mikvah. And there obviously is value, and it's very important and special to go the night of the mikvah. If somebody is not able, because it's a difficult circumstance, and both the husband and the wife agree that they're willing to give up on going to the mikvah the night of the mikvah, and they are not trying to have children, then many rabbis will allow a lady to push off going to the mikvah to the next night, okay? If this is a circumstance that happens, it's not something that we just say, oh, I don't want to redo my makeup. I'll just go to the mikvah tomorrow night instead, okay? It's not something that we approach flippantly. It's something that is, taken very seriously. And if it is pushed off, then it's something that requires, both the husband and the wife being okay with it, and even in that situation, the heter from the rabbi, and feeling like it's not taken lightly and it's something serious to be pushing it off. But these are kind of some of the options if going to the mikvah Friday night or any night that is our mikvah night is very difficult, then there are other options out there.
Okay, so kind of based on what Nachama just said, the next question is, hi, I've always gone to the mikvah on weeknights, and now I need to go to the mikvah Friday night or maybe Motzei Shabbos, and I don't remember how to do that. So I'm just going to go through quickly how to go on Friday night, how to go on Motzei Shabbos, and also how to go on a 2 or 3 day on day. So for Friday night, all the preparations for the mikvah would be done during the day before Shabbos starts at home, including bath, combing hair, cutting nails, removing makeup, etc. All should be done at home. It's recommended that after one combs their hair, they should tie it back into a pony or a bun or something that's going to keep it not free until they get to the mikvah. The next thing would be to light candles. If someone's going to be driving to the mikvah, then you would light, like Nechama said, Al Tnai, with the condition that you're not accepting Shabbos until after you've got in there. If someone's going to walk to the mikvah, then you light candles as regular, and you could walk to the mikvah and go. As a side point, which is addressing your question from before, we are very lucky in Chicago that the Chicago community is really willing to help women fulfill this mitzvah on time and to do it on a Friday night. So I know in Skokie and I know West Rogers Park, I think you can call the mikvah or the Friday night mikvah lady, and if you are concerned about walking alone, who's going to watch my kids, all that kind of those things, they will help you figure out a solution. It should be noted that halacha will say that a husband should stay home from shul if that is what will allow his wife to go to the mikvah Friday night. It's okay for him to stay home from shul to watch the kids. If you give me 1 second. And so it's preferable for him to stay home if that's what's going to allow the wife to be able to go. There are, I believe in West Rogers Park, there are people who will babysit your kids for you. There are walking groups. In Skokie, the mikvah lady picks up a whole group of people, depending on what corner you want to meet on, and will walk there, and everybody waits together until they're done, if that's what they want, and will walk back together so that nobody is walking alone. And then when the woman gets to the mikvah, since you did a thorough checking of your body before Shabbos began, when you get to mikvah on Friday night, there's not much you can do because it's Shabbos already. You're going to still look a cursory glance at to make sure nothing's on your body. You could run your hand through your hair to make sure that there's no loose hairs, but you want to be careful to not pull out any hairs with your hands. And before we do our official dunks in the mikvah, you want to either do an extra dunk or get some water on you so that you're wet when you're doing your dunking. That's for going on Friday night. If someone needs to go on Motzei Shabbos, so we do all the preparation, if we can, on Friday as well. On Shabbos, she can eat regular Shabbos meals, even though usually on a mikvah day we don't eat meat or chicken. She may on Shabbos. She can wear makeup. She can wear deodorant on that Shabbos. But keeping in mind it's a mikvah day for you, so on any like on any other mikvah day, you want to try to stay away from sticky things, nutty things, things that are going to give you more of a problem. After Shabbos is over, she would go to the mikvah, shower at the mikvah, comb her hair again, and check, clean her teeth if she's eaten, which I'm sure she has over Shabbos, and check and go into the mikvah. If a woman is not able to do her preparation on Friday, she can still go Motzei Shabbos, but she's going to have to do all of her preparation Motzei Shabbos, and it's going to take longer. So it's actually nice if she can do it on Friday. It saves her some of the time on the actual mikvah night to be able to go then. And in terms of going on a Yom Tov, either on a second night or a third night, it's the same as going kind of like on a Motzei Shabbos. You would do all your preparation on the Erev Yom Tov. Again, she can eat chicken and meat. She can even wear her makeup, even though not like heavy, heavy makeup probably. And then when she gets the mikvah, she would just take off whatever she could take off, check, run her hands through her hair to make sure that there's no loose hairs, and wash any parts of her body that got dirty. But that would be going on the second or third night of Yom Tov. Did you have a question about
that? No, I just wanted to comment. I noticed it said the mikvah, I took a picture of it.
The card that says to call? Right, that's at the Chicago.
The first paragraph that says, that's a husband's obligation to stay home.
Oh, to stay home. Oh, no. But I think, is that at the school camp? I think it's at the Chicago. Right. Yeah.
Just to make the night? Just kidding.
Always the husband should stay home.
Isn't it hypocrisy if, like, it's a 3-day Yom Tov and you're going to go on the second day? I mean, you're really not so clean. You're going to wear makeup the first 2 days. You're going to wear deodorant. Your hair's going to get messed up.
Yeah,
so
but the halacha,
right,
exactly. But the halacha really says that you just do it and it's okay.
There's also a hierarchy of a lot of different halacha mm-hmm. at play there,
right.
Because you have the mikvah prep, you have Simchat Yom Tov, you have a whole lot of things, so it's a very complicated situation. So the bottom line is, you do all the prep before, you live life with Yom Tov and Shabbos,
right.
And then you,
you
go to
try
the
your best
because it's like,
what you can do.
Also, Rav Willig says we're all pretty clean. I mean, we're talking about women who took a bath once a month when they went to the mikvah. So comparably, we're really, really, really clean. I mean, we're talking about 1 or 2 days. Also, we have to realize that there's a hierarchy of what is a chatzitza d'oraita, what's a chatzitza d'rabbanan, what's a minhag. Much of what we do now is considered a minhag. So when we're talking about, you know, going to the mikvah and having all this stuff on Yom Tov, midoraita, we're not going in with any chatzitzas deoraita. It's really just like the minhagim that has prepped up, but with Yom Tov being a halacha, it's important to keep that in mind as well, the balance.
I don't know if there's a last question. Hi, I'm 53 years old. I haven't had a period in 6 months, and I just saw some brownish, reddish stuff on toilet paper. What should I do? I have no idea if this is a period or not.
So it's actually pretty straightforward. This is obviously a woman who is going through menopause. I actually learned last week from Dr. Ellman it's called perimenopause, that we all use the phrases wrong. As a woman's period is changing and getting a new schedule, that's called perimenopause. The 12 months when she doesn't get a period is called menopause. After those 12 months have passed without a period, she is done with menopause. Last week, Dr. Ellman did a fabulous explanation of what the physical effects of menopause are, what it looks like, how it feels, what to do, and she made it very clear that every woman needs her own consultation with her doctor of how to handle it and what to do with it for in terms of medication and what to be expecting. So I definitely refer everyone to Dr. Ellman from last week to hear the physical medical piece of menopause. As far as halacha, it's pretty straightforward. If you see a stain or you get your period or you're not sure what it is and you don't know how to call the stain, it's a shayla, and it's just like everything else we talked about with staining. If it is determined that it was enough staining that she became a period, that it became a period, it became her flow, she'll do what she used to do. 5 days, 7 days, use the mikvah. And then the other ramification of that would be, how does she keep her calendar? Most poskim will say that she will keep her benonit day, which is the 30th day. Most poskim will say she will keep her her haflaga day, the interval, which could be very long, and some will say that she should keep her hachodesh too. It will actually, according to one rav that I spoke to, it will determine how old she is and how long it has been. And the quote from the rav was that if she's over 53 and her previous period was 90 days ago, she doesn't have to worry about anything. So those are just marking points to know about. But the bottom line is, when a woman is going through this process, just as she will be in touch with her doctor to make sure she's taken care of medically, this is going to be very personal, and she should feel comfortable calling and asking the question to help her through. But everything is treated regular. The stains need to be determined if they're nida or stains, and then depending on that, she will proceed forward. The one idea that I like to throw in about menopause is, some woman once said to me when she was going through this process, she said, the hardest part for me is that I don't know when the last time I'm using the mikvah will be. And it struck me as very emotional, because we don't get that choice. So as our bodies go through that and our bodies change, we can keep in mind there will be an end point to this mitzvah for us. There will be a time that we are not doing this anymore. And I was very struck by her emotion, and the spiritual piece of it is that we don't really know. She's like, I'd like to have a party. I'm like, I agree, that'd be nice. But we don't know when that last time will be. So we should embrace it and enjoy it as it's our opportunity in our lifetime.
Thank you so much for coming. Yes. Yes.
What you have developed here in Chicago, have you been asked to consult about this in other communities?
I've been called from another community. It was
or
a different scenario.
Set up this hotline?
They would have, but they couldn't in their particular situation. It just wasn't going to work for their community. But I have been called about it.
So this is a standalone
Chicago point. Only. Chicago Pride. Look at that.
Yeah.
As far as we know.
Yeah. I think all three Vidya together, right. I don't think exists anywhere else. There are other hotlines available. We would never claim to be the only hotline. But I think all three media, anonymous and confidential via email, web form, and phone, and you know, you get to choose, I think that is unique.
And there is an element that you touched on that we like, that's local. You know the rabbanim that we're asking, you can send us to your rav. You could then at some point. I've actually, sometimes this happens on the hotline, if there needs to be a confidential conference call, sometimes we will do that. Or if a woman wants to ask a question to a rav but doesn't know how to reach him, doesn't feel comfortable, the hotline can be the mediator sometimes if that's needed. But it's local. It's local so that we have connections to the rabbanim and the halacha.
The bath is not halacha. The bath is just something like, correct?
There are many, many, many minhagim associated with chafifa. In terms of the bath specifically,
I would say it's,
I thought it was really recommended.
It's fairly recommended.
In terms of like softening the skin and things like that.
If you ask the psak for yourself, that could absolutely be an answer that you got. But I would not make the
bath
doesn't make bathroom at home is totally fine. No one has to take a bath. You don't.
But also, and that's actually a really important point, just in general, as a woman gets a psak for her that she spoke to a rav about for her situation, just like you wouldn't say, my doctor told me I should take this, you should take it too. I mean, for something, an ailment that's happening or something, you sought out professional advice. It goes without saying that any psak given to one person for their situation is not to be carried over for another psak for any other woman when it's been asked personally. So you might have gotten that psak for you. But I would say that's definitely what we call personal
And on the same vein, if there's something that bothers you or you have a difficult time with for the mitzvah, it could be that a rav will find a different solution for you. As if a bath doesn't work for somebody, maybe a rav would say that person doesn't need to take a bath. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying we should not have a particular thing that we say, I hate X, so I am not going to the mikvah. Because many, many, many times, if you hate X, the halakha will try to work around X if it's workaroundable. I know that's not a word, but if it can be worked around, often the halakha will work around it, and we should not just say, you know, I know there are some ladies that say, I don't like taking off my nail polish. I'm not going to go to the mikvah. And there are situations where women go to the mikvah with nail polish. So, like, there is nothing that we should say, I'm throwing the baby out with the bathwater and I'm not doing it, because there is so much the halakha will work around if it is a sincerely, intellectually honest issue for that person.
By the way, everyone should feel free to leave. We are happy to take more questions, but I know it's already 9:30. Yes, sorry.
Thank you so much.
Do you want it not recorded?
Yeah, let's
Are you sure? I didn't mean to say that for you. I just felt bad that everyone's sitting here and whatever.